Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Over the past 30 years, Brian Skerry has spent more than 10,000 hours underwater photographing life in the oceans and seas. From diving in tropical coral reefs to beneath the polar caps, Skerry's work has been featured in numerous publications, most notably National Geographic. When not capturing intimate photographs beneath the waves, he can be found lecturing on his craft and on conservation issues at places like Harvard University, the Royal Geographical Society in London, and just last week, the Kauffman Center for the Performing Arts as part of its National Geographic Live series. Brian Skerry, welcome to Up to Date. So nice to have you here.
Great to be here, Steve.
Well, you've said this about photographing sharks. Brian, I have worked with sharks for more than 20 years and have never had incidents. They have been very polite. Polite? Really? What's the etiquette for swimming with sharks? Tell me about that.
That's a great question. And a big part of my work with marine animals like sharks is to help dispel some of the myths that have been built up around them. You know, I think most folks probably only know animals like sharks from what they've seen in movies and in sort of the Hollywood portrayal.
Yeah.
And the reality is much different. These are animals that are just one very important part of whatever ecosystem they happen to inhabit. And although they have the potential to be dangerous, it's not really what they're all about.
So you don't freeze up when you see them underwater?
Well, no, I wouldn't say I freeze up. I do have a healthy respect. You know, I certainly wouldn't want to give the illusion that they're, you know, puppies that we can go over and just pet or kiss like a cat. But, you know, they are animals that need to be respected, but I love photographing them. To me, a shark represents the perfect blend of grace and power. You know, they're very elegant, but yet they exude this confidence and dominance in the ocean. And as a photographer, I think that's a potential for endless amounts of great images.
So what's your sense, Brian, of how they regard you underwater? What vibe do you get from them as they sort of check you out?
Boy, that's so true. They do. They're very aware. You know, sharks have remained essentially unchanged in the ocean in about 400 million years.
Yes.
And the reason they haven't changed is because they haven't needed to. They're perfect. You know, they have all these abilities that evolution has created within them, the ability to sense the heartbeat of a prey fish or their lateral line, which picks up mechanical movements in the ocean and so forth. And they're very aware of you. So they're usually very cautious. You know, I think one of the things that most folks probably wouldn't realize is that it's not a situation where if you go into the water, sharks see a human and immediately come over to you. Just the opposite. They usually swim the other way. They are not particularly interested in humans for the most part. And in many cases, photographers need to attract them. They need to use, you know, scent or bait or something to bring them in. I'm not an advocate of baiting animals. In none of the work that I do, I do that. But with sharks, sometimes it's the only way you'll get them close enough to get a picture.
You know, of all the animals you encounter underwater, which one are you the most wary of?
Boy, you know, I think it probably would have to be sharks, but only in certain circumstances, and I can define that. I've been diving with sharks for over 25 years, and they have been very polite, and it's been very difficult to get close to them.
I love that word.
But that being said, I've been in a couple of situations. I was in a place called the Southern Line Islands, which is one of the most remote places on the planet, out in the middle of the Central South Pacific, places that other folks probably have never been and nobody's ever dived. And I was in the water at dusk, which is sometimes called witching hour for sharks because it's when they begin to feed. And there was at least 50 or 60 of these gray reef sharks that were around this particular evening. My assistant and I were in the water alone. And at that moment, something switched on, and these animals did, I think, regard us as potential prey. And it got a little dicey. We had to sort of ease our way into
shallow. Dicey in what sense?
Well, they started to come in hot, as I like to say. They came in, and normally when a shark gets really curious, I can, you know, usually just give it a little bump or tap with my camera housing, and they veer away. And these guys were doing a quick 360, coming right back in, and, you know, for every shark that was close to me, there was another 5 or 10 behind it. Literally 50 or 60 sharks by the time I exited the water. So to answer your question, that was one of those cases where I did get a little afraid and needed to get out of the water, and I think that's, you know, having that healthy respect. It's an anomaly. It's not usually the case, but that was one.
Do you think they sense your fear?
Oh, I definitely do. I think all animals do. I think a dog in your neighbor's yard senses fear.
They see you twitching your head a little more quickly than usual, and they know something's up.
No question. And yeah. I also think that, you know, there's strength in numbers. If I'm alone in the water and there's a dozen sharks around, they will behave differently than if I have my assistant there sort of watching my back or a couple of people sort of watching my back. I do think that, you know, they have learned to survive. I mean, it's no different than an apex predator on land, a wolf or a lion or something that understands that.
It's an interesting idea what you just said about someone having your back, because sometimes when you're under the water and you're photographing, you're by yourself, and you don't know what's coming up directly behind you, right? Which has got to be something that's got to be a little uncomfortable.
It's exactly right. And, one of the luxuries of working for National Geographic is that I usually do have the ability to bring an assistant with me. And most of the time, I like that assistant to be in the water. Now, there are cases where I'm particularly concerned that the animal will be spooked or, you know, if we have too many people and it's a shy, elusive animal. So I will be in there alone sometimes. And if it's a dangerous animal or potentially dangerous, then, yeah, you have to be concerned.
We're visiting with National Geographic underwater photographer Brian Skerry. You know, if you had one dive left in you, Brian, and you could go anywhere on the planet to make that dive, what would it be? Take us there. Tell me about a place that's just so magical for you that you just couldn't go back there often enough.
Well, you know, I tend to be drawn to colder waters, largely maybe because of where I come from. I grew up in New England and in sort of the Gulf of Maine, so those temperate, colder waters attract me. I've done a fair amount of work in icy realms, you know, under sort of pack ice and so forth. But these temperate, nutrient-rich waters, like in British Columbia, Canada, or in New Zealand, or even in Ireland, I was in a few years ago, I did a story, they tend to not be dived quite as much because it takes a little more equipment, it's a little colder, you have to wear dry suits and so forth. But yet, the marine life can be stunning. You know, I haven't done a great deal of work in British Columbia, in Vancouver, places like that. But yet, what little I've seen is absolutely stunning. You know, it's as vibrant and rich as any coral reef in the world, but in a way that's unique. You know, the giant starfish and sea anemones, and then you've got, you know, vertebrate fish like wolffish and octopus invertebrates, and all these other creatures that are just teeming with life in these places. They don't get seen quite as much because it's a little harder to get to, and as I said, requires more equipment. So, you know, I think if I had one dive trip left in me, I might go to a place like there or Alaska or someplace
like
that.
See, I would have bet money you would have picked the Bahamas or New Zealand or a warmer place, and here you are surprising me here.
Yeah, but that's always been my sort of draw. You know, I love everything in the ocean, and it's, for me, about the story. I'm driven by the story.
Your assignment.
Correct.
What you're after.
Yeah, and the stories that I do for the Geographic are stories that I propose for the most part. I'm working on my 21st story, and I think, you know, 18 or 19 of them have been my idea.
And what's this one?
Well, I'm currently working on a story about bluefin tuna. And I'm starting a new one about dolphins and dolphin minds, dolphin cognition.
Oh,
and
really?
I'm very, very excited, yeah, about that.
It's a lot of stuff to know about that, right?
It is.
Are they as smart as we think they are?
Well, I think they may be smarter than we think. And again, I'm not a scientist, but the researchers that I'm working with on this project have sort of intimated to me that we don't really understand fully a dolphin mind. You know, I've talked to researchers who've been studying these animals for 30 years, and they say, you know, we've historically been trying to understand them with our own human perceptions, but these are animals that see the world acoustically. They're voluntary breathers. They have to, you know, tell themselves to breathe. Even when they sleep, they have to have one half of their brain awake for predators. And I think that their world is so different than ours. It's like trying to understand an alien species here on Earth, you know?
It's an interesting way to put it.
Yeah. So we're, you know, they have the second biggest brains next to humans on the planet, and we don't fully understand, as I believe, just how those minds work.
You know, what is it about the world of beneath the surface of our oceans that is so attractive to you, Brian? I mean, what do you enjoy about it? What is it about under the water that's so cool, as opposed to you've obviously made that choice to go beneath the surface instead of staying on top of it?
Well, you know, from the time I was a child, as a young boy, I can remember being attracted to the ocean. I mean, as a child, I was interested in exploration of all kinds. I wanted to be an astronaut. I wanted to explore Sure. jungles and, you know, all these great things. But there was something particularly mysterious about the ocean. And I think it was that sense of mystery, the sense of potential discovery that lie beneath the waves that really spoke to me.
It's a different environment. It's a different
thing. Yeah, it stirred my soul and continues to do that. You know, the thing that I lay awake at night dreaming about are, you know, all the potential that exists. You can go diving anywhere in the world and you'll never know what you're going to see. You know, the ocean is one of the last wild places on the planet. There are no fences. There are no corrals. There's the potential for any animal to swim in on any given moment. And whether it's a giant animal or a tiny little creature on the benthic level, there's always something fascinating to discover.
Which came first for you, the diving or the photography, and when did you get started with each one?
It was the diving that came first. As I said, I started out wanting to be an explorer. I can remember reading National Geographic as a kid or watching Cousteau documentaries.
Yeah, sure. I remember those too.
Yeah.
It's too bad we don't have something like that.
It's so true.
Even today. That was such an important part of, inspiring. Yeah.
So many people, I think. And, you know, so when I was old enough to begin scuba diving at about age 15, I did. And it was maybe a year or two after that that I attended a diving show, a conference in Boston called the Boston Sea Rovers, the oldest dive show in the world. And I remember as a teenager sitting in that audience and watching documentary filmmakers and photographers present their work and sort of having this epiphany that I realized this was the perfect career for
me.
I could be an explorer, but with a camera, because I loved storytelling. I was a visual person, and the notion of traveling around the world and diving and making pictures, telling stories, just seemed like the perfect career.
Well, why haven't we replaced Jacques Cousteau with something else that's down that avenue?
Well, you know, I think about this a lot, and I ultimately became a member of that dive club, the Boston Sea Rovers, who puts on that big show. And I became their president and then their chairman of the board for a number of years, and I helped organize, you know, bringing in speakers. And, you know, back in the 60s or even the 1970s, the attendance at those shows was probably greater or more enthusiastic to some extent than maybe it even is today, because if you were interested in those kinds of things, exploration, the ocean, whatever, coming to a show was the only place you were going to get to meet
those
legends.
That's where you interacted with it. Yeah, I get
today,
it.
Today, you know, but back then we essentially had three channels. You know, on Sunday night I watched Lassie and Ed Sullivan and Disney.
Me too.
Yep.
Yeah.
And today, you know, we've got hundreds of channels, and we cater to special interests. So if you're into crocodile hunting, you can find a show about that, or, you know, whatever. And so I think to some extent it's been watered down. And I also think that it's harder for an explorer today. We've got great explorers doing great things, but it's a little harder to capture the demographic of everybody when, you know, TV is so spread out. I mean, that's just my opinion, but, you know, Cousteau was a pioneer, number one. He was one of the first, and he did it at a time when everybody was watching that channel, let's say, on Sunday night or whatever day
he could
own
that thing.
He owned it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the next day on Monday, people at work around the water cooler were saying, well, did you see, you know, Cousteau last night? It was new. It was fresh. It was exciting.
Yeah.
And you had a captive audience that I don't think we quite have today.
Underwater photographer extraordinaire Brian Skerry of National Geographic is our guest. Tell me how you made your way to the National Geographic to begin with, because that's such a prestigious magazine. Mm. How did you get there? And good for you for getting there, by the way.
Thank you.
Yeah.
It was a long evolution, Steve. You know, from the time I realized as a teenager that I wanted to be a photographer, I set my sights on National Geographic. That was the Mount Everest. That was the place that I wanted to work. But in those days, as today, there was only, you know, three or four underwater photographers working for the magazine, and they were well established. They didn't seem to be going anywhere. So for many years, you know, as I sort of progressed, I went to college. I studied photojournalism, photography, film.
Yeah.
I sort of perfected my craft. But I, you know, I came from a blue-collar, working-class town in New England. I didn't have the resources to travel around the world, so I started diving in New England. I did a lot of shipwreck photography. I worked on charter boats to help pay my way to go diving for free, and just kept chipping away at it. I slowly started to get assignments from dive magazines. I started to sell stock photography to make some money. I did speaking engagements. I would do whatever I could, but even that wasn't enough. I had to get other jobs. You know, I worked in these textile mills in New England, and I worked in packaging corrugated box plants, and I did whatever I could to make money while I was in college, after college. Eventually, you know, I always had the photo business on the side, but many of those years I was spending far more on equipment and travel than I was making it. But eventually it started to turn the tide. And to ultimately answer your question, I got my first assignment with National Geographic through a veteran National Geographic photographer who I had become friends with. It was a guy named Bill Kurtzinger.
I was going to ask you about Bill.
Yep, yeah. I was a big fan of his for many years. And, you know, through the years, I had met so many of the diving legends, but I had never met Bill. And then sort of later in his career, we met. He actually called me one day when I had a picture published in National Geographic. I photographed a very rare animal that had never been photographed before called an oarfish. It was the animal that inspired sea serpent legends. And a living one had never been photographed, but I made a picture of one in the Bahamas, and it was published in the magazine. And he called me, you know, sort of out of the blue and congratulated me, and we struck up a friendship. And over a period of a few years, he came with me on some of the trips that I was doing to places like Australia, the Bahamas, and so forth. And then one day he called me and said,
he had a challenge for you, right? Wasn't that the...
Well, sort of. He called me and he said, here's the deal, Brian. I've got two assignments that I'm working on for the magazine. And one of them I want to do. One of them I don't want to do. And he said that the story that he didn't want to do, it was a shipwreck story. He had been out to this site the year before. He described it as a place where there was really nothing to photograph. The ship had sunk in the 1700s, was all buried. The visibility in this place was absolute zero. He said it was worse than zero. You know, it was just really, really bad. Mm. And he just wondered if there was even anything there. And he said, you know, I think with this assignment, you're going to have about a 98% chance of failure if you take it. And with National Geographic, you're only ever going to get that one chance. So you might want to wait for a better opportunity to come down the road. I thought about it, and I realized that a better opportunity or another opportunity may never come. So I said, you know, please recommend me for that. And based on his referral and a brief portfolio at that time, they gave me a chance. And pretty much everything Bill said was true, but I really worked my butt off. I figured out ways to make pictures. At that time on this shipwreck site, they were beginning to discover treasure and parts of the hull. I figured out ways to get pictures even with the bad conditions. And the Geographic really liked what I did, you know. And
well, how did you get photographs of a shipwreck when there's no visibility? Do you make it like a movie set? You're stringing up lights, or what are you doing?
That's exactly what I did in many ways. Well, the problem, and I had been doing a lot of shipwreck photography in those days. I'd written books about it, and you know, I'd been diving the Andrea Doria and deep wrecks and German U-boats and all this kind of stuff. So I felt confident that I could do it, but I got to this place. It was off Cape Cod. And even though I had dived New England my whole life, there was a condition in the water that I'd never seen. There was this weed that they called mungweed, local term for it, that was like swimming through egg drop soup. I mean, that's the best analogy I can give. And
it's a good analogy.
You know, if I was trying to photograph a diver working on the hull and I was 3 feet away from him, there was 3 feet of this weed basically between us. So the traditional way to make photographs is to have your camera with strobes on the camera to light it up. Well, those strobes were just lighting up all this junk in the water. So I had the idea to bring in movie lights that I owned, these 1,000-watt cable lights. I had a generator brought in, put it on the boat above, and I had divers holding the lights.
God.
And using negative film, back then I was shooting film, and instead of slide film, which was less forgiving, the negative film gave me some latitude with exposure, and I was able to, you know, make these sort of eerie pictures of the divers silhouetted with these lights, and you didn't see all this, all the backscatter and all the weed in the water and all that stuff. And then I, as they were finding treasure, they started to find Spanish pieces of eight and doubloons. So I switched to macro photography, and I showed pictures of the coins in situ and some of the artifacts they were finding. And it all worked, you know.
That is so cool.
Yeah, well, you got to figure things out.
Gold doubloons, they really exist.
They really do. On one of my first dives out there, I found a Spanish piece of eight dated 1709. And I remember tucking it into my wetsuit mitt and bringing it up and giving it to the guy who was running the project, hoping that he would let me keep it, but he didn't.
What's that worth?
Oh, you know, I have no idea. Certainly worth a lot. But the nice thing, actually, about this project was they kept all the treasure intact, and it's actually traveling around the country now as a museum display. So kind of interesting.
You know, what is it about shipwrecks? Because anyone listening is going to be drawn by this notion of a shipwreck. And I remember doing a show, I'm going to space on his name, the guy who discovered the Titanic.
Bob Ballard.
Bob Ballard, okay, yep. You know, from any number of years ago.
Yeah.
And he told this story of coming across the Titanic for the first time with that vessel he went underwater in that was specially designed to withstand that kind of pressure. And the moment he came across that shipwreck, and to call the Titanic a shipwreck almost undersells it. But what I remember so vividly about his description of that moment was in the moments before he actually came across the structure of the ship, what he saw first were shoes.
Yeah.
And what was so interesting was the shoes were still preserved, you know, all these decades later because of the compound in the leather that preserved them and allowed them to stay underwater and maintain their shape and everything. And you saw shoes leading up to the actual shipwreck, which is an image that has always stayed with me all these years later.
No, that's very true. Bob is actually an old friend, and I remember him telling that same story to me about the debris field and leading up to the main superstructure of the Titanic when he found it. I think to answer your question, Steve, for me anyway, there is this sense of discovery with a shipwreck.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's...
You're the first guy there in decades and centuries maybe. Yeah.
You might be the first one to touch that porthole or that ship's wheel since the ship went down hundreds of years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't help but wonder who the last person to touch it was. You know, I wrote a book in 1995. It was my first book called Complete Wreck Diving with a colleague, Dr. Henry Keats. And it's basically a how-to book on how to go and find shipwrecks, how to dive them, how to preserve artifacts that you find, all these things, how to do photography on shipwrecks. And I remember writing about those things in the book that, you know, it's often the scene of a disaster. You're coming on a scene where drama played out hundreds of years ago, and you might be the first one, if you discovered the wreck, to actually witness this stuff. And there's a sense of sort of creepiness to that, but also a great sense of discovery. And I think human beings just have this natural curiosity to want to explore and to discover, and a shipwreck is a great way to do it.
How do you find shipwrecks? And can I do it tomorrow?
yes is the answer. You absolutely can. I mean, most wrecks that divers go out and dive today are known sites. They're known places where the ships have been discovered and charter boats will take you out.
Are there many sites that where they haven't been discovered yet?
Yeah. I mean, you know, where I live in New England, I live near Boston, and in New England waters, back, I know, in the day when I was doing a lot of shipwreck diving, I remember a statistic that said there was about 5,000 wrecks in New England waters, known shipwrecks, and only about 10% had been discovered.
Oh, really?
So there was plenty of opportunity. And you know, not to belabor the point, but the way you would sort of discover that is first do a lot of research. You know, you go into these old archives and you find reports on where the ship sank. A lot of times the Coast Guard listed reports or notice to mariners, or there were all these things that even predated the Coast Guard, the Revenue Cutter Service and these things. And they have great documentation of when ships sank, or if it was a battle, if it was a naval battle or something, then you can sort of piece it together. And then it's a detective story. You're trying to go out there in the ocean and figure out where it might be. And there are tools that we can use today. There are things like side-scanning sonar, which can see, you know, half a mile on side of your boat, either side, which covers a big swath of the ocean. It's how they found the Titanic. You can use a magnetometer, which is essentially towing this thing that picks up anomalies in the earth crust metal. So if there's a big iron wreck. So there are these techniques and tools that we can use to find them. And then it's a matter of hopefully if it's not too deep, you can scuba dive on it.
Brian Scarry, a National Geographic underwater photographer, is our guest. He was in town last week. So when you come across a shipwreck like this, is there an etiquette for, you know, assuming you're the first one who's come aboard this ship in decades or even centuries, is there an etiquette that sort of exists for how you're supposed to approach that ship?
Well, there is, and I think more importantly perhaps than the etiquette is the law. And the laws are dictated by sort of regional areas or states. So if a shipwreck is within state waters, then state has jurisdiction over what can be done. you know, if it's outside of state waters, then it falls into federal waters. If it's outside of federal waters, then it's sort of an international. But there's, you know, a lot of admiralty law that sort of explains what can be done and what can't be done.
So if it's within state law, does that mean the state gets a portion of whatever you find there?
Yes, they do. Now, again, by and large, most shipwrecks that divers are going out to explore have no real commercial value per se. You know, they're not all laden with gold and treasure right. and things like that. The vast majority of wrecks, for example, on the eastern seaboard of the United States were probably old schooners or World War II shipwrecks that sunk or, you know, just ships that foundered in rough seas. And there's nothing particularly valuable. So if a diver goes down and is swimming on a wreck that's 60 or 70 years old and you find a beautiful brass porthole laying there and the diver wants to retrieve that porthole and bring it up and clean it and polish it up and put it on his wall at home, you know, most folks would say there's no problem with that.
Yeah.
Now, again, you have to consult local laws and you have to know because, you know, the state of Massachusetts or Maryland or Rhode Island might have very specific laws about that. So divers need to understand what the legalities are. But for most shipwreck divers that are into artifact hunting and souvenir collecting, that's the kind of thing that they're talking about. They're not talking about treasure.
Well, have you come across a shipwreck where there were gold doubloons on that shipwreck? I mean, have you had that good luck yet?
No, nothing that I've discovered on my own. And that very first assignment that I did for Geographic.
That's the wrong answer, by the way.
Yeah, right. Well, I wouldn't divulge it, I suppose, if I did. No, I honestly haven't. And, you know, I love wrecks and I love that history. But, you know, the vast majority of everything I do these days is wildlife. You know,
yeah.
That's where I've sort of shifted. But I'm still always interested in a good shipwreck tale.
Well, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our very good conversation here with National Geographic underwater photographer Brian Skerry. In our second half, we'll talk about his very close encounter of the dangerous kind with giant squids. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And welcome back. I'm Steve Kraske. We're visiting with Brian Skerry. He's an underwater photographer with National Geographic magazine. He just was in town last week speaking at the Kauffman Center for the Performing Arts as part of the National Geographic Live Series. He has a new book out, just came out a little bit ago. It's called Ocean Soul. It came out about a year ago, and it's a mid-career retrospective of some of Brian's work. Tell us about that book a little bit, Brian.
You know, I read a long time ago that most photographers that are out there working today were inspired by a book. Even though we read magazines and we see pictures in many different places, most photographers that were inspired to become a photographer can sort of point to a book that really inspired them. And that was the case for me with a book called Wake of the Whale by Bill Kreutzinger. But so for many years, I wanted to do a book. But, you know, as a photographer, you're always working on new projects and you say, well, you know, let's just wait a little longer. Let's wait a little longer because then I'll have these pictures to include in this.
Yeah.
But at some point, you got to pull the trigger and
yeah.
say, this is what we're going to do. So a couple of years ago or so, I met with the folks at the National Geographic Book Division and we talked about this book. And I really wanted it to be a collection of my best images, my best work, but also a narrative that would involve a few things. I wanted to give readers a sense of what it's like to be a National Geographic photographer. You know, it's often been called the greatest job in the world, and
right.
I would never argue with that. But, well, there's
sure.
another side to it, of course.
Yes,
you know,
of course.
There's challenges and obstacles and frustrations and all the things that go with it. And it's sort of fun to write about that and relate those stories. But also, a big part of my work these days is looking at environmental issues. There's a lot of problems occurring in our world's oceans.
I wanted
that to be about that as well. And, you know, I sort of arrived at the title, Ocean Soul, based on a question that I had gotten many times over the years about what it is I try to photograph. And I ended up sort of answering that one of the things that I try to capture with my work is the soul of an animal. Now, that may seem a little tricky or not so true. But, you know, I've often felt a sort of a life force that exudes from certain animals. And it's not something you can easily capture. But occasionally, I'm sort of lucky to be able to do that. And it comes down to just shooting a lot, being in the right place at the right time, getting a certain gesture or grace in the animal. And those are the kinds of images that really speak to me. So Ocean Soul then is really about that soul that exists with creatures and with places in the ocean, and also sort of as a double entendre, it's how I see myself. It's as a person who spent most of his life traipsing around the world in the ocean.
Well, describe an image in Ocean Soul that you're particularly proud of. Can you describe it for us? I know it's radio here and it's trickier, but tell me about an image that you're particularly proud of.
Well, if I could cheat a little bit on that question, I would answer it by saying there are two images that immediately come to mind. I mean, hopefully I'm proud of many of them and all of them. But
two or 22.
But there's two at opposite ends of the spectrum that I'm proud of for various reasons. The first is an image that has probably become my most famous image, if I can use that word, a picture that sort of took on a life of its own. And it's a photograph I made of a whale, a southern right whale, swimming up to my assistant standing on the bottom. Now, this was a story I did for National Geographic about right whales. And the North Atlantic right whales, the most endangered species of whale in the world, there's only about 400 of them left. And to draw a comparison with that beleaguered population, I went to the subantarctic of New Zealand to try to photograph this newly discovered population of southern right whales that had never seen humans before, underwater anyway. And it was a very speculative trip. I didn't know how the animals would approach me, if they would, if the visibility would be good, the weather would be like. But I was able to spend weeks with them making a series of images, and I had this picture in mind, which came true, and it was a 45-foot, 70-ton right whale swimming up to my assistant, standing on the white sandy bottom at 70 feet. And there's just something about that juxtaposition of a human standing on the bottom of this giant whale
I've seen that image,
That really speaks to people on a you know, I think a primal level.
It's interesting that you had your assistant stand there instead of you yourself.
I was there. I was as close as he was. You just don't see me because I was holding the camera. But you know, I think that's, to me, it celebrates how the ocean was supposed to be. These are animals that had never seen humans. They had no sort of bad experiences with us, and they were very curious and came right up to us. You know, these animals were named the right whale because they were considered the right whale to kill by early whalers. They were slow moving and they floated after they were dead. But these whales hadn't had that experience yet, so they were still very curious. And I like to think that's how the ocean was hundreds of years ago. And if we could go back in time, we would see all this great stuff. So that, to answer your question, is one picture. On the other end of the spectrum, there's an image in the book that I did for the magazine as well of a dead shark. It's a picture of a thresher shark in a gill net. And it was a part of a story that I did on the global fish crisis, the problems of overfishing in the world. And right now, you know, we've lost 90% of the big fish in the ocean due to overfishing in the last 50 or 60 years. And today on planet Earth, we are killing in excess of 100 million sharks every year on planet Earth, 100 million sharks. So when I went out to shoot this part of the story, I sort of wondered how I would make a picture that would resonate with readers of a dead shark, because people are afraid of sharks and, you know, how do you do that? Jumped in the water in Mexico this one day, swam along a gill net and found this thresher shark. And a thresher is a pelagic animal that has these huge pectoral fins, and it had just died. So its eye was still open, and these outstretched fins, as I was framing it up in my viewfinder, it sort of struck me as a crucifixion. And I thought that maybe that would give some empathy to that issue. And it ended up being the lead picture in the story. Mm. It's gone on to have a life of its own. In fact, last year I received a call from the president of Chile who wanted to use it in a PowerPoint presentation to his government.
Wow.
I learned later in the year that Chile banned shark finning. So, you know, these images can be powerful. But for different reasons, the whale picture is a very celebratory picture. The shark picture is kind of a tragic picture. But both are important to the ultimate story of the ocean.
Do you get a sense that humankind is becoming more and more aware of this sort of this overfishing that you're talking about? Is, you know, the word is sort of out? Are we responding to it in a way that's even close to adequate in your view or not?
Yeah, I do. I do remain optimistic, and I do think there is some traction occurring in the world with these sort of oceanic problem issues. You know, when I started doing conservation photography more than a decade ago, I was sort of one of the first in the ocean that I was aware of that was trying to make pictures of some of the bad things that you know, we wanted to show. And today there's a lot of people doing this, and there's also this sort of what I would call an arms race almost by many countries to create marine protected areas, which is one of the solutions. You know, right now there's probably less than 1% of the world's oceans that are actually protected. But in recent years, many countries are beginning to create these large swaths of their EEZ, their exclusive economic zone, that are off limits to fishing. And, you know, it's in our own best interest to do that. We need replenishment zones. We need places where fish can reproduce and be left alone.
There's this new trend out there, certified sustainable seafood, which is this notion of what? Explain it.
There is this organization that does certify seafood, and I honestly, in all fairness, don't know a great deal about
this,
but I can.
This fish has not been overfished, I guess.
Right. You know, and again, it's very confusing for the consumer, and I acknowledge that. But I think we have to, if we care, we have to sort of educate ourselves. And those things like certified sustainable fish are important to understand, but it doesn't always mean that it's a perfect choice. You know, there's an organization that does certify these things, and a couple of years ago, I think they certified krill. Because technically it wasn't being overfished, but I would argue that we shouldn't even be fishing krill. You know, that's a baseline source of protein for so many animals in the ocean that, you know, it should be left in the ocean. I don't think we need to be fishing it. So it's, you know, it's a little dicey, but there are some good things happening too. You know, I'm working on a new story for the Geographic. Actually, I just finished it on aquaculture, on farming fish. And although historically aquaculture has not been the best friend of the environment, there are today some really wonderful things happening. There's some great technologies and methods being employed. And I really think that is a solution along with creating more marine reserves in the ocean.
Underwater photographer Brian Scarry is our guest. A famed oceanographer and marine biologist Sylvia Earle was on our program a few years ago, and she told us she doesn't even eat fish. Do you?
Well, I do, but I'm very selective. And Sylvia is a great friend, and I really look to her for inspiration, and I respect her opinion. I love seafood, but I am very, very careful and cautious about what I eat. You know, where I live near Boston, codfish and haddock are very common, or were. But even though you can get those species occasionally these days, I choose not to eat that. I would rather select, you know, some form of shellfish that's very sustainable, or an aquaculture species that's being grown, a cobia or tilapia or something like that, that allows me to still get my sort of fix for seafood, but I know that I'm not doing any harm.
What can ordinary folks, Brian, I'm wondering, you know, here in the relatively landlocked Midwest do to help the oceans?
Well, it's a great question, and I think it goes back to making choices. I do think
just as you do every day, it sounds like,
absolutely. Yeah. You know, and I think being aware, sort of educating yourself about what is okay to eat and what's not okay to eat, is a great first step. We shouldn't underestimate the power that a consumer has. You know, I read recently that a lot of the seafood that's consumed in the United States is done so in restaurants. So just because you can go into a restaurant and get a piece of Patagonian toothfish, known as Chilean sea bass in most places, doesn't mean you necessarily should. I think there are better choices. And, you know, it takes a little bit of work. We have to sort of read a little bit or educate ourselves. We can get these seafood watch cards that help us to pick, you know, species that are better. But I think that's one of the things we can do. Another thing we can do is, you know, choose not to drink from plastic bottles, you know, buy a recyclable container, an aluminum container, and fill it with water and drink from that, because plastics in the ocean are a real problem. And, you know, choosing to do that here in Kansas City can make a difference as to what happens in the middle of the South Pacific, believe it or not.
You know, being underwater is usually a very quiet experience if you're diving alone, I'm thinking, but sound obviously is amplified underwater. What's the most beautiful thing you've heard during a dive?
Wow, boy, that's a really unique question, and one that I've not been asked before.
That's what we ask here on Up to Date, Brian. So I'll give you a few seconds to think about
I think I can instantly answer that, and it would have to be whale sounds. You know, to hear a whale calling underwater, like a humpback whale, is otherworldly. It's primal, and it just resonates through your whole body. It's really captivating. And you know, another thing was, I remember when I did a story about harp seals a few years ago, I charted a fishing boat, a crab fishing boat, And I was in the Gulf of St. Lawrence in Canada near Newfoundland in wintertime, and we used the boat like an icebreaker. And we lived with the seals for weeks at a time. And at night, as we were in our bunks, you could hear the seals calling, both on land and underwater. And it sort of just vibrated through the steel hull of the boat. So as you're in your bunk, you heard these sounds. Yeah. And I've heard that kind of thing in other places. I've heard dolphins, and I've heard other marine mammals with echolocation and calls that resonate through the hull of our boats. And it's a very haunting sort of primordial sound.
I'd really like to hear that sometime. That
yeah.
sounds pretty cool.
Yeah.
You know, I'm just wondering, you know, you talk about photographing when you're in the very cold climes up north, down south. Your equipment can even freeze in situations like that. How do you deal with that mechanically? How do you deal with it with your own body trying to work in conditions like that?
Yeah, diving in cold, harsh places is just so much harder than in warm tropical places. Everything is hotter. You have to wear so much more equipment. You know, when I'm diving in icy places, that water temperature is about 28.5 degrees Fahrenheit. I wear a dry suit that has gloves attached, and I have to wear glove liners, like mountain climbing glove liners underneath, which makes dexterity very tricky. So just operating the controls of my camera takes a lot of time. I've probably got the better part of a couple hundred pounds of equipment on my body, so swimming is a challenge. And you can only stay underwater for brief periods of time. Even with all that equipment, you're still going to get cold. Your face, you know, you have to have two hoods and just it's really restrictive. But you do it. You know, you find a way to figure it out. I train a lot. I'll practice wearing this stuff in dives near home in preparation for going to these icy places. And then, you know, there's the mechanics, too, as you described. You know, your regulator can free flow underwater. It can just begin to, you know, expel all the air in your tank. So I often have redundancy built in. I have two of everything and have abilities to sort of shut things down and switch over to other systems underwater. But again, it's bulky, it's cumbersome, you have a lot of stuff on, and it just makes it that much harder. And things break, you know, the cold is very harsh on equipment.
Boy, that sounds tough. Let's turn to something a little warmer. You went swimming not long ago with the Humboldt squid in the Sea of Cortez off of Mexico. What is the Humboldt squid?
Well, the Humboldt squid...
The squid's the one animal that gives me the weebies, just so you know where I'm coming from here.
Well, the squid are fascinating animals. They always intrigue me, but the Humboldt squid is probably, in my estimation, one of the most fearsome sea monsters in the sea. You know, I rarely would give that name to anything because most animals in the ocean are pretty darn cool and very interesting. But if we were to design a perfect sea monster, I think it would be the Humboldt squid. The Humboldt squid is an animal that grows to lengths of about 13 feet.
Man.
So it's not as big as the giant squid, you know, which can get up to 50 or 60 or more feet. But scientists tell us that the Humboldt has a more superior musculature. It's a stronger, fiercer predator. All of its arms and tentacles, like all cephalopods, it has 8 arms and 2 tentacles. But the Humboldt has arms and tentacles that are lined with little teeth, effectively.
And I watched a video of you showing off one of those things, exactly. Lots of teeth.
24,000 teeth.
24,000 teeth.
You know,
teeth.
And
yeah.
They're not true teeth, but they're the like teeth that they can grab their prey with, and their mouth is a beak. It's like a parrot, and it can take about a quarter-sized chunk of flesh out of their prey, and they travel in schools of hundreds and thousands. I remember before I went out to photograph Humboldt squid years ago for the very first time, I remember reading some of the literature that stated that they travel in packs of thousands and they're known to, quote, eat anything that moves, which was very comforting as I was about to dive in the sea at night, which is when you're going to find them.
And you did that then. Why?
Well, because I was intrigued again. You know, I was fascinated.
It was something to conquer there, I guess, and get a picture of. Yeah,
you know, there are these animals that just stir my soul, and I'm intrigued by them, I'm fascinated by them, and I want to make images. I want to tell stories.
They're 6 to 8 feet long, again, 24,000 teeth. And what was it like to be amongst them and be that close as you were to them?
Well, it was a very unique experience. They were very different in the way that they move through the water than anything else I had photographed. You know, I was used to photographing sharks and other predators that are somewhat predictable. You know, they'll swim in a certain pattern. You can see them coming. You can sort of anticipate their movement. A squid is this little jet-propelled alien spacecraft that can move in any axis. They can be above your head one moment and below your feet in the next, and they don't have these predictable patterns, and they glow. They have iridophores and chromatophores, and they can change color and skin patterns, and they are truly like a little alien being or a little alien craft. So to see them coming in the darkness and sort of glowing in this big eye, and then, you know, they're curious, so they reach out these arms and tentacles to sort of test you. They grab you, and oh yeah, I mean it was pretty wild.
And what do you do when they do that?
Well, you know, I was a little apprehensive, so, you know, my first reaction is to sort of use my camera housing to fend them off, to sort of push them away or to pull away when they grabbed me. I remember one night I was hanging on a rope, a line that we had put off the back of the boat, and I was down about 30 or 40 feet, just hanging in the darkness, waiting. And I had my camera housing on a lanyard around my right wrist, and I was holding the line with my left hand. And in the darkness, I all of a sudden felt my arm just being pulled up. The squid had come in the darkness. I didn't see it. And it grabbed my camera housing, was trying to swim away with it. And because I had a lanyard and was holding it, my arm just sort of went up. So, I just kind of jerked it back and pulled it away from the squid. There was no problem. I mean, they weren't overly threatening. I've heard about cases where they have grabbed divers, and, you know, two squid dragged a diver down a number of years ago and he had to wrestle free. They pulled the regulator from his mouth and a gold chain he had around his neck and some collecting bottles he had on his waist. So evidently they have the potential to be a little more fearsome, but I didn't really see that side of them.
And you thought that, why didn't that happen to you? It could have happened to you.
Yeah, I guess it easily could have happened to me, and I don't know. I mean, these are animals that we don't really understand. So many animals in the ocean we don't fully understand, and we're just beginning to put the puzzle together.
I gather that you have a fairly high fear threshold. Am I right about that, Brian?
Well, no.
You're doing stuff that I'm not sure I would do.
Well, maybe, but, you know, it's come over time. There's been an evolution. You know, when I first started diving when I was 15 or 16 years old, I wouldn't have jumped into the ocean where the water was thousands of feet deep at night in the Sea of Cortez and tried to photograph Humboldt squid. But after 35 years of doing this, it's I've built on the experiences. So, you know, I started with small animals and photographing them and learning behaviors and sort of getting a bit of experience with that, and then learning bigger animals and different things. And, you know, collectively, I've been very blessed, very privileged to be able to call on those experiences. And, you know, that being said, I'm no hero. You know, if I feel that things aren't going right, or I have that sort of little voice inside of me telling me that there's something just not right, there's no shame in getting out of the water.
And you do that sometimes.
I do. You know, it's like going into a neighbor's yard on one day and you see their dog and you get a good vibe from it. And another day, that dog is just giving off a vibe that you sense, this primal thing inside of us that I think keeps us alive, that says, you know, we just shouldn't be there. And I think you have to listen to that.
Again, National Geographic photographer Brian Skerry is our guest. You know, maybe one final point. A few minutes ago, you were talking about one of your maybe most famous shots about the whale sort of going up to your assistant on the floor of the ocean, this giant whale against this, in comparison, very, very small assistant. And you mentioned that you had sort of framed that picture, that photograph, in your mind prior to going down underwater. And I'm wondering, how often do you do that? Do you have an image of a picture that you seek to get, and you venture off and try to get what your mind had imagined?
Yeah, absolutely. I think most photographers do that sort of pre-visualization.
Yeah.
Before you go out on assignment, you have images in your mind. Some photographers, including myself, have even sketched it out, you know, on a piece of paper, on the back of a napkin. You know, you're sitting there with a pencil and you sort of have this picture in your mind that you would like to produce. And I have colleagues that do this all the time at National Geographic. And it doesn't always work out that way. Sometimes it does. But at least it gives you an idea of what you might be able to make possible. And then you have to sort of see how things evolve when you're there.
Do you work that out with your editors ahead of time at the Geographic, or is it pretty much you yourself sort of working that out?
Well, in that case, it's probably the photographer themselves working that out. But I will say that the process with the editor is very collaborative. You know, I've worked essentially with one editor throughout most of my career. I've worked with a few, but the Kathy Moran at National Geographic is the editor that I've worked with the most. And it's very collaborative. You know, we talk for months before I'll go in the field and try to get a sense of exactly what we're going to produce and what the coverage plan is going to be and what we hope to piece together. And it's definitely a team effort.
Well, Brian, it's been a pleasure to have you.
My pleasure.
Thanks
so
much.
Great to be here. Thank you.
And by all means, travel safe, swim safe, dive safe in the years to come.
I sure will.
Again, that's Brian Skerry with the National Geographic Magazine. His book, Ocean Soul, it's a mid-career retrospective. That book available out there. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR. Up to date, you can follow me at Steve Kraske. Our show is produced by Steven Steigman, Danny Alexander, and Beth Lipoff. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you are up to date.